We are joined tonight once again by Simon Winchester, who was last with us just a while ago when we talked about his excellent book, Krakatoa, The Day the World Blew Up. We talk about something a bit more benign, though also full of drama, namely the making of the Oxford English Dictionary. And the newest book by Simon Winchester is titled The Meaning of Everything, The Story of the Oxford English Dictionary. I must give you a wonderful little quote from, of all people, Mae West, who says, I've been in who's who, and I know what's what, but this is the first time I ever made a dictionary. She shows up in the dictionary, I'm not sure which one, because of the Mae West life jacket.
I think it's the OED, actually.
The OED, yeah. Originally, yeah.
Yeah.
Which was used during World War II.
And is puffs up rather extensively around the chest area. Yeah. I think that's the point, isn't it?
Of course, Winchester must be in the OED, at least for the name of the rifle, and for the name of the British town.
And the cathedral, very much
and
so.
And the cathedral.
In fact, when I introduce myself in this country, I have to say Winchester spelled like the gun, whereas in England I have to say Winchester like the cathedral.
And the cathedral given a new significance in musical culture by the Beatles.
Was it the Beatles?
Winchester Cathedral.
Was that the Beatles?
I'm quite sure. If I'm wrong, somebody will correct
me. I'm sure they will. It's a very popular song, but I thought it might not be the Beatles, but I don't want to start our 2 hours having an argument with you.
That's the first question we raise for our listeners, and somebody can give us the definitive answer in the second hour. But let us begin to look at this. Of course, the first significant English dictionary was done by Samuel Johnson. Everybody knows that story. And many of us have seen and read some of the more amusing definitions, the one about Oates, the one about Scotsman, and so on.
Yes.
And the one about lexicographer.
A harmless drudge, basically. It goes on to talk about how he compiles the signification of words. Excise, a hateful tax. It goes on about how it's levied by wretches, the rate of which is designed entirely by those to whom it is paid. Network is the most complicated. I don't know if you've got it in front of you. I can never remember it.
But I can give it to you in just a moment.
That would be wonderful.
Samuel Johnson must have written this himself. This is not network, but net.
Okay.
Net is defined as anything reticulated or decussated.
Decussated, yes.
Is that what you say that? Decussated. It's a word I don't use very often.
No, quite.
Anything reticulated or decussated at equal distances with interstices between the intersections.
Yes, and so what on earth does that mean? I mean, he's guilty of this amazing definition of the word elephant, which I love. I mean, first of all, you've got to assume that in 1755, when his first dictionary came out, the Channel Tunnel not having been dug, there were very few elephants wandering about in England at the time. So Johnson probably would not have seen many of them. But he has this long and beautifully written definition. But then he gets into the matter of elephants having sex. He realizes that there's some value in having sex, and brings in the readers. And so he says, in copulation, the female takes the male lying on her back. I don't think so. Somehow the thought of a little female elephant lying legs akimbo with 20 tons of testosterone enraged.
To tell you the truth, Simon, I can't, now that you raised the question, or now that Johnson has raised the question, I can't imagine how in the world elephants do it.
Well, I do know, actually.
I suppose
it's not too vulgar.
The male mounts the female from behind.
From behind, standing on a little hill. I think that's the problem, because their organs are about 3 feet different in height. But the thing about that particular definition is it goes on, because it says, and such is his pudicity.
Ah.
But the problem is that one of the axioms of dictionary definition writing, which Johnson drove a horse and cart through innumerable times, not least in that appalling definition of network, is that you're never supposed to include in the definition any word that is more complex than the word you're defining. And I would warrant, even among your listeners, that few know the word pudicity.
I've never heard it as a word, but my instant association is to pudenda.
It's precisely the same. It's that of which we are ashamed. It's essentially saying, such is the elephant's shyness, that he never covers the female so long as anyone appears in sight. In other words, Johnson made the whole thing up.
Questions of that sort arise, if you're doing a real dictionary, all the time, 10 times a day, I suppose.
Yes, they do. I mean, it's the most incredibly complicated art is, I mean, jumping very fast forward for a moment, I found a notebook dated 1919, a spiral-backed notebook that belonged to J.R.R. Tolkien, who was an assistant on the dictionary.
I learned that from your new book, which, if you've forgotten, is titled The Meaning of Everything, The Story of the Oxford English Dictionary.
Well, and he labored mightily, I mean, filling this whole notebook with his ponderings on how to write the proper definition of the word walrus. So elephant taxed Johnson in the 1750s, and walrus taxed J.R.R. Tolkien mightily. It's almost better simply to invent a word like he did with Hobbit, because he got that into the dictionary and didn't have to think about the
but
definition.
But is walrus, as we have it in the present, OED, the definition originally provided by Tolkien?
It certainly is. The full definition of walrus I can get to you if I look at my book. I'm not sure. I think the definition in the OED and the definition in the shorter are obviously rather different. If I can just quickly go to walrus.
You certainly can.
Okay.
In fact, while you do that, I will pause just briefly and we'll take care of the first batch of commercials and then we will return. And back to Simon Winchester. We are celebrating the publication of his new book, which has been widely heralded in reviews that have only recently appeared. That book is titled The Meaning of Everything, The Story of the Oxford English Dictionary. And it's not a surprise that that book is published by Oxford University Press. But it's a great delight to read. As I suppose the OED is a great delight to read if you pick it up and just fool around for a while.
It's just full of serendipitous pleasures. I mean, that's the wonderful thing about it. It's, if you go to it, you cannot put it down. You just gee whiz. I mean, even if you're looking at one of the, most people know that the word that is occupies most pages in the OED is the word set, S-E-T, which occupies 62 columns, 32 pages or something. Hundreds and hundreds of meanings of the word. So you might go to volume 9 or whatever it is and look up set and think that it might occupy your attention for perhaps 2 minutes. But it doesn't. You find you're looking at it and thinking, my God, does set mean that? And it means this, and so it does. And you just go on and on and on, and before you know it, an entire evening has been, I won't say wasted, but used up.
Now, what about walrus?
Well, Tolkien's definition is as follows. The seahorse, or morse, Trichichus rosmarus, a carnivorous pinniped marine mammal allied to the Phocaeidae, eared seals, and the Otariidae, sea lions, and chiefly distinguished by two tusks or exserted upper canine teeth. It inhabits the Arctic seas. A variety found in the North Pacific has sometimes received the distinct specific name of Trichichus obesus.
Obesus?
Meaning
I
very fat,
fat,
I think, yes.
Well, that is a fairly thoroughgoing definition, I suppose. But it does commit the very mistake you were talking about. The word pinniped is, I suppose, more obscure than the word walrus.
Neither you nor I know what it means.
No, I still don't. I was hoping you did.
No.
But it's clearly a biological classification word.
It is.
Because it's a pinniped mammal. Ah, ped, but ped means
feet.
Feet.
And pinny. You've got the volume of the shorter there, I guess. You
well,
look
the,
up.
the short definition, and I'm working from the shorter Oxford English Dictionary, which is a mere two volumes of about £10 each. But the short definition is a large pinniped mammal, Odobinus rosmarus, allied to the eared seals, which is distinguished by two large downward-pointing tusks, and is found in the Arctic Ocean. It does also, of course, deal with the etymology, but it doesn't give you a quotation in which walrus is used.
Whereas, of course, in the OED, there are zillions of quotations. And the joy of looking at Tolkien's notebook is that his handwriting is so majestic. I mean, if you look at the end papers for Lord of the Rings, you'll see his beautifully drawn maps where that same kind of writing and calligraphy is displayed.
The Lord said, let there be light, and everything that happened followed that command. A bishop, a mere bishop, said, named Richard Chenevix Trench, the first of many wonderful names that we encounter in this book of yours, said, let there be a great English dictionary.
He did, and the reason for that is when he stood up on the 5th of November 1857 at a meeting of the Philological Society of London, he had originally billed it to talk about what was called the Unregistered Words Committee. Just to back up a moment, the first ever dictionary of the English language had been published in 1604, some long time before Johnson. It only dealt with hard words, difficult words that sort of fops and people with, you know, long wigs and ruffled jerkins and things would use to, including conversation, to make themselves sound more learned than they usually were. And these were frightfully ugly words like bulcitate and commotrix and archgrammaton.
Would that be done at high table at Oxford in the 17th century?
In the 17th century, it probably would.
Yeah.
So this man, a man called Robert Cordery, thought, as nobody seems to know what these words mean, but they love using them, why don't I provide a sort of vade mecum, a slim volume they can slip into their coats, and then any time they want to say something to impress one of their company or their partners or a woman they want to chat up or something, they can dip into my book and utter one of these words. I would like, my dear, to bulcitate you tonight. And who knows what might then happen. It was a tremendous commercial success, such that by the middle of the 17th century, there were dozens of such books. Then Samuel Johnson came along and decided, it's all very well to have a lot of these little specialist dictionaries, but why not produce a dictionary of the entire English language? And that's what he did. It took him 5 or 6 years, and he produced a dictionary of 40,000 words, but littered with the kind of definitions that you were talking about earlier.
But he had another purpose as well. He wanted to sort of protect the language from its decay. And he says about his purpose in an essay in The Rambler, I have labored to refine our language to grammatical purity and to clear it from colloquial barbarisms, licentious idioms, and irregular combinations.
This was indeed his initial view, but it wasn't the view at the end of his labors. And that's actually, you bring up a tremendously important point in the history of lexicography. Should a dictionary's purpose be to define and prescribe the language, to say, this is the language, it's pure, and this is how you use it? Or should it be a language which simply describes the language, which says, this, with all, you know, warts and all, is what the language is?
The choice between being normative or being descriptive.
Precisely. The French prescribe how it should be used. So do the Italians. I mean, they have this committee, the 40 immortals in Paris, who to this day preside over the linguistic purity.
And they rule out words.
They rule out
more than they rule in.
Oh, many more these days. I mean, gracious me, think of the number of words that have been introduced into the English language. So many have been repelled by the 40 immortals, not the least of them being words like le sandwich, le nightclub, le weekend, which the French use, but very much against the wishes of the committee.
Not to mention le smoking, which is a smoking jacket.
Which is a jacket, exactly. Well, this was Samuel Johnson's initial view, supported by people like Jonathan Swift, who said we shouldn't even use words like isn't and can't and wouldn't, that these are barbarisms, uneasy on the ear, and they shouldn't pollute the English language. After 2 or 3 years, Johnson changed his mind and said, no, the remarkable thing about English is the fact that it is so flexible, that it incorporates so much, it's very Catholic in its appeal. And words don't have a fixed meaning. They have changed.
But surely that's really true of all living languages, isn't it?
It's true of all living languages, but I think the argument in the lexicographical community is that by seeking to determine the purity of a language, you condemn it to death, ultimately. And while I've no wish to join in the anti-French mood that gripped America 10 months ago, I think it's fair to say that despite French being the language of diplomacy still, you know, we still see it on our passports, whether we're Americans or Bangladeshis or Englishmen, as an alternate language, despite one or two appearances, French is not nearly as universal a language as English. The French want their language to be universal, think it should be universal, but it isn't. And one of the reasons it isn't is because it's so rigidly prescribed. Whereas English, I wouldn't say we don't care. I think English lexicographers love English. but they don't mind if ketchup is allowed to come in from Cantonese or amok from Malay or berserk from Icelandic.
Of course, you start your book with the languages that piled up one upon the other over the course of centuries in the British Isles, thus producing the modern English language, which took its final form, I would guess, in the 17th century, or in the 16th. Elizabethan English is clearly our language, even though there are some words and constructions that seem a little odd. But you do a quick once-over, a run-through of the history of the language, and let's talk about that even right now before we get to the job that was done in response to the injunction from Bishop Trench. The first language that was used was the language that the Celts brought with them. They came from elsewhere.
So it is said, although oddly enough, just last week I was sent a fascinating, slim, and privately published book by a man called M.J. Harper in England, who's talking about creation myths generally. And he says, how do you know that the Celts brought the language? I mean, what do you know about the Celts?
He read your first chapter, did he?
Well, yeah, it feels much like that, yes. Yeah. It's a swinging attack on the generally perceived beliefs about the origin of the English language. He says there is no real evidence. But
well, isn't there archaeological evidence, so to speak, that before the Celts came, the islands were not inhabited by human beings?
That seems to be certainly not human beings that used a language. Yeah. So let us assume then that the Celts, who seem to come from somewhere in the northern reaches of the Danube Valley, found themselves in England.
They only get there about 500 BC, or thereabouts.
Yes, they do. And a very small number of the words that they use survive in English today. I mean, I am a very keen mountain climber. And two words that we use a lot, the word cum, C-W-M, mm-hmm. which indeed, I mean, this year was the 50th anniversary of the climbing of Mount Everest, and one of the important ridges that leads up to the final summit is known as the Western Cum. Well, that word cum, C-W-M, is a Celtic word. The word tor, T-O-R-R, which you see a lot of them still in Dartmoor, there's a pile of rock called Yes Tor. That survives as a... And also, we think the word cross might possibly be Celtic. The word London is almost certainly mm-hmm. Celtic. One or two rivers, the X, E-X-E, for Exeter and Exmouth. So there are maybe 50 or 60 words which survive. But then, of course, came the Roman invasions, which brought some Roman words into the language, particularly, I mean, Winchester, for instance, I mean, Chester, to do with the Latin word for castle.
Most people will be surprised, unless they know this period in history, to learn that the British, rather the Romans, controlled at least and occupied the southern half of the British Isles, or of the isle on which England is located, occupied the southern half for some 400 years, longer than the United States has existed.
That's the most extraordinary reality, isn't it? And of course, they left a number, many, many physical remembrances of their having been there, not the least of them being this huge wall.
Hadrian's Wall,
yeah. Right, you know, the northernmost of their fortifications.
That was to keep out the Picts.
To keep the Picts at bay.
The Scots.
The Scots. Well, the Celts that retreated into the mountains.
Right.
But these roads that they built all over Britain die straight, and which still exist. I mean, Watling Street, for instance, still exists, mm-hmm. running across Cambridgeshire. And there are lots of Roman forts. And where I come from in rural Oxfordshire, many is the day when a farmer will throw up some Roman coins or tiles.
And we throw up Latin or Latin-originating words in English all the time.
Well, we do, but I mean, a lot of them are religious. I mean, words like alb and anchorite and mass and mile, of course, from mille passus, mm-hmm. a thousand paces. Then the Roman Empire, like all empires, the British Empire, of course, it overextends itself, it decays and collapses, and you know, eventually the Huns attacked Rome.
Are attacked only within the year in Rome itself.
They are indeed. Yeah. So then who next comes to Britain? Well, people from Northern Europe, from Jutland, from what is now Denmark, from Northern Germany, from the Baltic, they swarm over in their longboats and land at various places in England, places like Northumberland and Lincolnshire and Yorkshire and Kent, and they bring their Germanic, their Teutonic languages, into England. And the mixture then, a little bit of Celtic, a little bit of relict Latin, and quite a lot of Teutonic, produces Old English, which is the English which, well, produces, among other things, the famous or infamous four-letter words that we are supposed not to use. But it's a very simple language, although lots of very direct, blunt words like earth, bread, half, earl, you know, not complicated words. And a lot of people today, or in recent years anyway, George Orwell being most notable, says we could speak English these days simply by using those words, the lovely language of Old English, which is quintessentially English. It's very ancient.
But then you can't say quintessentially.
That's the point. You couldn't use pompous words like quintessential. I wonder what you could use that would be from Old English to say the
simply.
Same as, I'm sure simple
is
probably an Old English word. Then you get more Latinisms brought in by missionaries and so forth. So, once again, tends to be the words of missionaries. So
and then 1066 changes all that.
The infamous moment. Every schoolboy in England knows that date.
There's this wonderful comic book that English kids read, or English teenagers used to read, 1066 and all that.
Sellers and Yeatman.
Which bottles up just about everything in British history.
It's the most wonderful thing about certain things being good things, a bit like Martha Stewart, and certain things not. 1066 changed everything because it was the Norman invasions, and they brought with them their language. So we get an awful lot of words for food. I mean, things like pork and beef and mutton and things like that.
But you get the French language actually spoken at court. William the Conqueror becomes a king of England, though he doesn't spend much time there. But then for the next 200 years or so...
The language of the court
French
is
the court language, isn't it?
It's the court language, but it's not the people's language.
No.
They're still speaking a language which is now an admixture of, to sort of repeat, Celtic, Latin or Roman, North German,
but they
Jewish.
Must pick up the French words from the gentry as the gentry passed by.
That being the point. And so you get a whole raft of new words being brought into the language, such that by the end of the 13th and 14th century, the language is getting pretty big. I mean, we're talking about a language with maybe 100,000 words in it, dominated by French.
And it reaches a stage where, in fact, it can be understood by the modern reader or the modern listener, with a little effort and with some footnotes.
Yes, I mean, you look at Chaucer, and you can broadly get it, can you not?
Shall I do for you the opening lines of the Canterbury Tales?
Please do.
Of the prologue. You can translate as we go.
I'll do my best.
One that April with your sure is sorta, the drocht of mersh hath persed to the rota.
I don't think I can, but I'm sure it's about April showers.
When that April... with her sweet showers, her sure sota, the drought of mersh,
the drought of March.
Of March has pierced to the root. On that on bothered every vein in switch liqueur of which vertu engendered is the floor, and Zephyrus ache with her sweat of breath, in spirit hot, in every halt and heath of the tundra clopus.
Is poetry. Well, it is poetry.
It sounds beautiful.
It does sound
beautiful. It's because of that terminal E on so many words.
Yes. No, I mean, and Chaucer set the standard. I mean, for
if you see that printed,
you can
pretty
work
well
it out quite easily.
Yeah.
Following Chaucer, then, it evolved, improved, expanded, and Caxton, of course, allowed it to then be read because he produced the movable type printing press. Having brought it over from Europe, he set up in the just outside the precincts of Westminster Cathedral. And started printing. First of all, the first document, the Recueils of Troy, essentially a French book, or in Norman French, but nonetheless started producing all manner of texts and producing them cheaply for people to read. And in this, I mean, Caxton had a remarkable effect in...
What are Caxton's dates?
Well, 1485 is the year that we remember as the printing press. So we're talking about the middle of the 15th century to the very beginning of the 16th. But he made certain decisions and which have had very far-flung impact. For instance, the word egg. In the singular, EGG, was accepted as... It was a Teutonic word. But the plural, in the north, in other words, the Jutes... and the Saxons that invaded the northern part of England called the plural of egg, iron, EYREN. So you buy one egg or two iron. Whereas those that invaded Kent, and so these are people more akin to the Danes, they said no, the plural was eggs, EGGES. I won't say anything so crude as Chaucer flipped a coin, but he made a decision that the plural in his printed word works of the word egg would be eggs, which is why we don't ask for iron either in England or indeed in this country.
Some great writers really fix or alter the language and sometimes put new words in the language as well, of course.
Yes, I'm wondering who you're.
Well, Shakespeare, surely.
Well, of course, Shakespeare. I mean,
Later on.
that was one of the extraordinary things about Shakespeare's talent, is that he had a vast vocabulary, but he had no dictionary to look words up in, because, as we mentioned, the first dictionary didn't come along till 1604. Shakespeare, what was he writing in 1604? I think As You Like It was written in either 1602 or 1604. And indeed, oddly enough, he uses the word elephant, just not to beat a dead horse, as it were, but where could he look the word up? How did he know that ELEPHANT, which is how he spelled it, didn't mean a piece of furniture or a holiday in Spain? But he did. He uncannily knew it and put it in his book, in his play, and the word achieved, therefore, more and more
Well, isn't
popularity.
that partly because the words are used verbally? I mean, they're used in speech, and some words are in spoken interchange before they wind up in any standard document.
Yes, of course, but he standardized the spelling of them, which was wonderful. Oddly enough, he misspelled the word accommodation. He, in one of his
Though
plays,
you say that's a word that he invents.
he invents it and initially spells it with only one M, which is
You track it to Othello, I think.
Othello, exactly.
What's the line?
I'll have to look it up, for
Othello
heaven's
says that
sake.
his wife should be treated with accommodation.
Yes, gosh, now let me have a quick look.
We needn't pursue it right now. But let us now go. How do we account for the fact that by Elizabethan times, the language has taken a form that really is essentially the form and essentially the content that we now have? Or put it another way, why hasn't the language changed at the same pace from the late 16th century, as it that being essentially 500, rather 400 years ago? Why hasn't it changed as much in these last 400 years as it did in the prior
Well,
400
I
years?
think the answer to that is quite simply that the linguistic history of England is essentially the history of invasion.
No.
We were invaded a very large number of times until after the 1066 invasion, there was no more invasion. And we started invading people. We started becoming, particularly once Elizabeth I was on the throne, we started exploiting
And
overseas.
that spread English around.
That spread English around, but also brought a small measure of English, of new words, constantly
Some
back.
Hindi words and words from the Indian
Well, precisely. I mean,
subcontinent wind up.
we first went trading in India in what, 1590? That's when we arrived in Surat, in West India. The East India Company was the ruler of the country from 1757 onwards, and after the mutiny in 1857, oddly enough, all of these dates exactly paralleled by dictionary milestones, because Johnson was 1757, the OED began in 1857. 1857, the Crown took over the country.
What are some of
And,
the Indian-derived words that are
well,
in
okay,
common
I mean,
English
in
now?
alphabetical order, I mean, bungalow. It's a Bengal cottage. We use bungalow now in England for a single-storied house. Veranda, that's a Hindi word. The open, what you in America call a terrace or where you sit
Or
outside,
a veranda.
or indeed a veranda. Cheroot, a small
For a
cigar
cigar.
or cigarette. Words which, I mean, there's a wonderful dictionary called Hobson Jobson, which is a dictionary of Anglo-Indian terms, which is absolutely vast, because the number of words which are, I mean, pajamas, that's a Hindi word. You don't use dark, DAK, in this country very much, but a number of old, I mean, my father would still talk about has the dark arrived yet, meaning the post, the mail, as
I've
it
never
were.
heard that one.
The dark, we use the word wallah
Yes.
to mean a person that does something. So a tonga wallah is a person that drives a horse.
There's a wonderful film years ago, an Anglo-Indian film titled Shakespeare Wallah.
Shakespeare Wallah,
about a touring company.
A touring Shakespeare company, yes.
In India.
Yes. Yeah. The Dobie Wallah, the person that does the laundry, has the Dobie come back. So, to answer your earlier question, invaders didn't bring vast lexicons as they had done in the Celtic times, in Roman times, in Norman times. But nonetheless, British imperial adventure did bring, words like tiger and leopard, animals that we found overseas. And we simply brought the names back that we found that they were called.
Tobacco is, in fact, an
Algonquin
Indian
word.
It's
Algonquian.
Word.
Algonquian.
Yeah.
So that's, tobacco is a classic example. The Algonquians didn't invade England. If they had done, we'd all be talking about wampum and tobacco. And there'd be huge numbers.
No. Walter Raleigh brought it back to England.
Yeah, he did indeed.
Well, Walter Raleigh, as you
Walter
folks
Raleigh,
say.
We call it,
right.
Yes.
Back to Bishop
Chenevix Trench.
Chenevix Trench, that wonderful name. So he gave that, he called for a new dictionary to the British Philological Society.
Yes, what had happened was there was this society set up in the 1840s to indulge essentially the British upper classes in their fascination with the English language. And a committee within this society called the Unregistered Words Committee was formed to collect in a book those words which they believed Johnson had left out. Because Johnson, mighty though his dictionary was, had only got 40,000 words in it.
And the current OED has how many?
The current OED, the second edition, has got 690,000. So a very, 15 times as many. The one that they're working on now, they think will have 980,000. So 20 times as many, 25 times as many. There was just a feeling abroad that there were more than 40,000 words in the English language. So there was this hunt was started for people to report to this Unregistered Words Committee any words that were not in Johnson. So by 1857, it was quite a thick volume full of words that weren't in Johnson. And on the 5th of November in that year, Chenevix Trench said, I'm going to make an address to the members of the Philological Society in an upstairs room in the London Library in St. James's Square, a building that still exists in London today, and report on the latest stage of our search for unregistered words. But at the last moment, he put up a notice saying, no, I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to make a speech, and I'm going to call it On Some Deficiencies in Our English Dictionaries. And this was the speech that changed everything, because he said, look, ladies and gentlemen, or rather gentlemen and gentlemen, there were no ladies in the Philological Society in those days, there are today. The dictionaries that we have at the moment do not serve us well. They're too short. They're full of definitions which are either plain wrong, like Johnson's definition of elephant, or which are politically supercharged, like Johnson's definition of oats, which for anyone that doesn't remember, it's a grain commonly given to horses, but which in Scotland feeds the people. And it's full of invented illustrative quotations, which we know that Johnson just dredged up from his memory, didn't find in any books. We need to produce a dictionary, gentlemen, that has every single word in the English language, with every single alternate spelling, every obsolete form, every pronunciation, the full etymology, however complex it may be to find out what it is, and all the meanings that it has displayed over the years of its existence. We need, in other words, to produce not so much a simple dictionary saying X means Y, but to produce a collection of biographies of every single word that's ever appeared in the English language.
I would submit that that's the definition of a perfect product, but it can never be achieved.
That, you would think, would be the response of everybody. And indeed, at the end of the first...
But you'd like to try to come close to it.
He said, well, though the men who filed out into the mist on that 5th of November 1857 said, wonderful idea, and maybe we're the people to do it, but it's going to be a gigantic task. And I don't know, they said to each other, as far as I can gather from letters they wrote to one another, I don't think we can do it. I mean, how on earth do we get every single word? English is like oxygen. How do you sort of catalogue the oxygen we breathe?
But all the same, they made a start.
Well, because Chenevix Trench came back the following week, on the 12th of November, and said, this is how it must be done. We must, in order to find out every word's history, we must read everything that's ever been written. And there was a sort of collective gasp. But he said, I'm not asking you, gentlemen, to do it. I'm asking us to assemble a huge army of volunteers from all over the English-speaking world. And that means not just in the United Kingdom, but also in America and Canada and South Africa and Australia, New Zealand, India. Anyone that speaks or reads or loves English, we will get them as volunteers, and they will read everything under our direction and send in, whenever they find an interesting word in an interesting context, they will write it down on a slip of paper and send it in.
And that's the beginning of the famous collection of slips.
The slips, the famous or infamous slips, yeah. All manner of adventures they had.
The first person to attempt to coordinate all of this, one might call him the first editor, was the grandson, was he, of Samuel Taylor Coleridge?
Yes, he was called Herbert Coleridge, and he was an extremely clever, very learned young man. He was 31 years old, much younger than Chenevix Trench or the other member of this Holy Trinity, a man called Frederick Furnival.
But the task killed him, virtually.
Essentially, I mean, a year into it. It's charming, really, his naivete in his approach. He called for people to send in material, and people did start sending in thousands upon thousands of quotations. And to accommodate these, he built, or had built for him out of chestnut, I think, a suite of 54 pigeonholes, like you might find in a post office. Into these 54 pigeonholes, he assumed that would be ample room to put in the incoming slips, arrange them alphabetically, and that, once they had worked, he thought, for 10 years, and produced a book which might be four volumes in extent, then he would have the totality of the English language under control and between hard covers. Well, he cannot have imagined what a woeful underestimate that was. 54 pigeonholes produced was lamentably small a number. The quantity of slips coming in he thought might be a few thousand. It was in the millions. It was something like 6 tons of paper. And the task that he thought might take 10 years and cost just a few hundred pounds to do, in fact, took 70 years and cost at least £300,000.
The first full edition appears in 1928, is that right?
April 1928, and that was 12 volumes, 414,000 words, 2.5 million quotations, and pigeonholes, well, tens of thousands.
You say something early on in the book about that first edition, which astounded me, and I don't quite understand how, where you get the figures. Here's a quantitative item. You say, I'll read this paragraph. The work that was unveiled during that glittering Goldsmith's summer evening, that's where they held the dinner.
The Goldsmith's Hall in London.
Goldsmith's Hall. Stanley Baldwin, then Prime Minister of England, addressed the group of eminent people. That summer evening was not simply magnificent in its unrelenting scholarship, it was almost unbelievably big, fat, heavy, shelf-bendingly huge, as a monument to the labor of those who fashioned it. And here we have these numbers that astonish me. A total of 227,779,589 letters and numbers, occupying fully 178 miles of tape, had over the 70 years just now ended been corralled into place between the thick blue or red Morocco covers of the first editions of this unanswerably monumental book. Yes, but where do you get, how could you derive the exact number of letters and numbers in the book?
Well, because I think the Oxford University archivists are so proud of the book that someone back in 1928
counted.
I've actually got his name, the counter. He's a man who never rode in a motor car. He never used a fountain pen. He was tremendously old-fashioned, he wore a lorgnette, and he counted every single word, every single letter.
Did anybody double-check him?
I think not. It would be a labor of Hercules to do
but
that.
Are we then to assume that he's absolutely accurate?
I would think, yes, well, they could count up, and they could derive from the weight of the lead of the letters, of course.
Well, now you could do it by computer process.
Yes, that would be such a dreary thing to do, though, wouldn't it? I love the thought, I mean, the weight of the book, not to dispute or get into whether 227 million is the right number. They believe it is, and I am not going to count to make sure.
We come to the crucial figure. The second editor after the death of young Coleridge is Frederick Furnival, And he fools around with it for 10 or 15 years, doesn't he?
Well, he fools around with all sorts of things. I mean, he's an
fools around with young women.
He loves women with large breasts.
Takes them on
boating trips, yeah. Yes. He's an incorrigible rogue, but a wonderful, wonderful lexicographer, mm-hmm. and altogether a marvelous man.
But finally, the action passes to the man who is the key genius in the middle of the long history, and that's James Augustus Henry Murray, about whom you've written in the earlier book, titled...
In This Country, called The Professor and the Madman.
Yeah, which is about the relationship between Murray and one of the many people who worked for him. In this case, somebody in an institution for the criminally insane.
An American called William Chester Minor, who came from New Haven, Connecticut, who went mad, was sent by his parents to recuperate in England, didn't recuperate, shot someone dead, and was sentenced to spend the rest of his life in a newly built lunatic asylum called Broadmoor, where he befriended the widow of the man he had murdered, which is extraordinary. She was called Eliza Merritt. And Eliza, who's apparently going to be played by Helena Bonham Carter in the shortly to be made major motion picture, she would bring him books for his library, which he had two cells in this institution, and one of them was his library. And so she brought him books. And one day, in about 1884, I think it was, he got this package of books and was undoing them excitedly, because he was a very keen bibliophile. He found a slip of paper, a little brochure, published by James Murray, who you've just mentioned, the editor of the Oxford English Dictionary, calling for volunteers to help with this great national undertaking. And in a flash, W.C. Minor thought, this is how I can redeem myself. I'm a murderer, I'm mad, I've done these terrible things, but I've got plenty of time on my hands, and I'm clever, and I'm well-read. I'll contribute. I'll work as a volunteer for the OED. And so he did for the next 40 years.
And then we must go back to his boss. That is, we must go back to Murray. Furtival wants to get rid of the full responsibility, and they need another editor. And there's somebody who sort of puts himself forward, though I guess Furtival also nominates him. And this is Murray.
Yes, Murray once made a passing remark. Murray, ill-educated. He had left school at 14.
No college at all.
None at all. He was the son of a draper in southern Scotland, and he had come down to London to work very miserably in a bank. But he had a voracious appetite for learning and a prodigious appetite, particularly for language.
I've got to ask you to read that quotation from the letter that he sends to the...
The letter of application to the British Museum. Oh, it's quite extraordinary.
It's dazzling.
May I read it all?
Please, I want you to.
This is a letter that he wrote to the... He wanted to get a post at the British Museum Library in November 1866. I have to state, he wrote, that philology, both comparative and special, has been my favourite pursuit during the whole of my life, and that I possess a general acquaintance with the languages and literature of the Aryan and Syro-Arabic classes. Not indeed to say that I am familiar with all or nearly all of these, but that I possess that general lexical and structural knowledge which makes the intimate knowledge only a matter of a little application. With several I have a more intimate acquaintance, as with the Romance tongues, Italian, French, Catalan, Spanish, Latin, and to a lesser degree Portuguese, Vaudois, Provençal, and their various dialects. In the Teutonic branch, I'm tolerably familiar with Dutch, having at my place of business correspondence to read in Dutch, German, French, and occasionally other languages, and I speak good Flemish, German, and Danish. In Anglo-Saxon and Muezo-Gothic, my studies have been much closer, I having prepared some works for publication upon these languages. I know a little of the Celtic, and I'm at present engaged with the Slavonic, having obtained a useful knowledge of the Russian. In the Persian, Achaemenian, Cuneiform, and Sanskrit branches, these I know for the purposes of comparative philology. I have sufficient knowledge of Hebrew and Syriac to read at sight the Old Testament and Peshto, and to a lesser degree I know Aramaic, Arabic, Coptic, and Phoenician, though this only to the point where it was left by Jacinius.
And he wasn't kidding.
He wasn't kidding.
He wasn't falsifying or exaggerating.
I believe he wasn't, but he didn't get the job, funnily enough. And he later said it was probably because my Phoenician was rather wanting.
Didn't get the job at the British Museum.
He didn't, but it was a good for us all, because eventually he was, having said idly at a meeting of the Philological Society, I'd love to have a go at it, meaning go at editing the OED, Finally, after a long struggle with the extremely sceptical delegates of Oxford University Press, who were very, very erudite men, very uncertain of having a bank clerk from Scotland without a university degree to take over editing the jewel, or the what might well become the jewel in Oxford's crown. I mean, there was, he ran into opposition from people like Benjamin Jowett, the master of Balliol, a man so haughty that they wrote a piece of doggerel about him. My name is Jowett, there is no knowledge, but I know it.
This is Balliol, I am Jowett. What there is to know, I know it. If I don't, it isn't knowledge. I am master of this college.
Brilliant, much better.
From the Mask of Balliol in the 1870s.
Yes. Yeah. So dealing with people like this, Murray's chances at first seem very slender, but in the end, he presented, he wrote some sample pages of the word arrow, carousel, persuade. They liked them in the end, and after about a year of humming and hawing, they finally said, all right, you can have a go.
And he had his go. He worked on it for 50 years.
From his appointment in the late 1870s until his death in 1915, he really whipped it into shape.
What was his method? What was his way of cracking through and doing this seemingly undoable job?
Well, the first aspect of it that was seemed undoable was these wretched slips that we referred to a number of times. Millions upon millions of slips. Furnival had lost an awful lot of them. You'd think that was impossible. You'd think that these things that had... Furnival lived in Primrose Hill in North London, and you'd think he would have kept them there. But no, he didn't, and for all sorts of reasons, when Murray started looking for them, they turned up in the oddest of places. All of the slips for the words beginning with the letter H, for instance, were found in Florence, in Italy. The A slips were in a house in Clapham, in South London, being held by a man who refused to give them up and said that if anyone tried to force them out of his house, he'd set fire to them. The PA slips, so words like paradise and paragon, you might think there might not be too many of them until you look at the OED. 352 pages of the dictionary are occupied by words beginning with the letters PA. They were all found folded up to be used as spills to light a fire in a farmhouse in County Cavan in Ireland. So the first part of James Murray's modus operandi was to get these slips. He built a house, I mean, in the back of his garden in North London. His wife paid £150 for a metal shed, saying, I'm not having these slips in my house. You can put them somewhere else, James. So she built or had built for him this little iron shed.
He calls it the scriptorium.
He gives it this wonderful name, named after the building that monks used to illuminate the manuscripts in. And he lined it with deal shelving and pigeonholes. So the original 54 pigeonholes of Coleridge, which became 1,024 pigeonholes under Furnival, were now something like 10,000 pigeonholes, because this was the immensity of the task that Murray realized confronted him. And
I must interpose for a moment to suggest how easily it could be done now with computer technology. They do it now with computers.
They do. I mean, there is this thing called the English National Corpus, which has got, I think, 100 million words in it. And if you want to know every single appearance of the word cat or dog, you can do it in seconds.
You still like the pigeonholes?
I love the pigeonholes. I love the erudition that's everywhere on display looking at those slips.
I fear we have to pause in the middle of the story. Some commercials are overdue, and then we need to do a very quick update on the news. But we'll be back to the pigeonholes and the making of the OED in continued conversation with Simon Winchester, drawn from his wonderful new book, The Meaning of Everything, the story of the Oxford English Dictionary. But first, these other words. And we go back to the scriptorium. Who were some of the people? There were thousands of people who were sending him slips, but there are some very interesting characters. We've mentioned one, namely the murderer in Broadmoor. Who were some of the others?
Well, I like a man called FitzEdward Hall. I must admit, when I first heard his name, I thought he was a college, not a person. But FitzEdward Hall was actually not just a person, but an American person.
Yeah.
Who, his father sent him out to look for his brother, who had gone missing in, they thought, India. And so this young boy went out to on a ship from Boston to Calcutta, I think, but the ship was wrecked in the Bay of Bengal. And the young fellow swam ashore and lived, found that it was a rather agreeable part of the world, and he learned Bengali very quickly, and then learned Hindi, and then learned Sanskrit and Urdu, and so well that he then taught in the local school, and then decided he really liked this part of the world and moved to central India, to somewhere like Lucknow or Benares, ultimately becoming a professor of Sanskrit studies. He married very well, the daughter of an English general, I think, in the British Indian Army, and then came back to London. I don't think he ever went back to America. He became professor of Sanskrit at the University of London, but shortly thereafter had a furious row with a German philologist called Theodor Goldstucker, and was denounced after this row for being a drunkard, a lecher, and a spy. And this forced his wife to leave him, and he, in high dudgeon, quit all his posts in London and fled to a cottage in Norfolk, from which he never left it for 42 years. And he even had his groceries and his laundry brought in, but every day wrote at least 5 letters to James Murray at the Oxford English Dictionary with suggestions, with quotations, with all manner of assistance, and was probably the most valued of all external contributors. Not, though, the most prolific. That honour goes to another madman. I mean, I think Fitz Edward Hall was pretty wacko, but he was a chap called Thomas Austin, who produced 166,000 quotations, which is an awful lot. I mean, can you imagine? It's hundreds a day, or hundreds a week, anyway. He went completely mad and was doing it from a lunatic asylum as well. In terms of names, I love the name Hereward Thimbleby Price.
I should think you would.
He was a great, great man, prolific contributor to the OED, who joined first of all, he married a German woman. He was very English. He married a German woman. He then took German citizenship just in time to be inducted into the German army just before World War I, fought on the Eastern Front in 1917 against the Russians, was captured by the Russians, sent to Siberia, escaped by walking overland from Siberia to China, and wrote a wonderful book called From Boche to Bolshevik, and then ended up as professor of English at the University of Michigan here in this country, died in 1964.
When did he start sending in his slips?
Oh, his slips started in about 1901, when they were working on letter R and T. I think they were just beginning this huge amount of work on the word take, T-A-K-E, which oddly enough, James Murray, when Furnival was dying, Furnival died in, I think, 1910, and he said, you know, that the dictionary goes on, but old dictionary men like me must die, so I think I've got another 6 months to live. And James Murray, who wasn't a tremendously compassionate man, he didn't suffer fools gladly, he was rather a strict Calvinistic person. The most endearing thing he could do to Furnival now on his deathbed was to send him a letter saying, would you like to see Take in its final stage now? And so dear old Fernie died reading Take, yes.
There were many others who were important in providing the slips and in providing the quotations, and you covered them. Some of them are wonderful eccentrics, just as are some of the people you've described. But let's understand, or let's explain for a moment why the quotation is so important. Now, I'm looking at the volume of the shorter Oxford English Dictionary, which I brought in from the office. I've got the second volume of the two, and just I've chosen at random the word unworthy. We've got the first definition is adjective, lacking worth, worthless, having little or no merit or value, especially of a person, despicable, contemptible, disreputable, harmful to reputation, unseemly, discreditable. Then there are yet other definitions given, but then down below is a whole group of quotations. Woodall, unworthy impostors under the names of surgeons. Shelley, these limbs, the unworthy temple of thy spirit. Wordsworth, I suspect unworthy tales have reached his ears. W. Besant, she repressed her indignation at this unworthy suggestion. Pope, That's Alexander Pope, one assumes. Cursed is the man, unworthy property, unworthy light, who delights in war, and so on. Why do you need all those?
You need them to illustrate the subtle changes, mm-hmm. the subtle differences between the meaning of unworthy. The shorter compresses them, but the full OED will say, okay, this meaning of unworthy suggests sort of stunted in development, let us say.
A. Thompson, he must be a bold man who will declare nature's beckonings to be unworthy of attention.
Yes, and that is a different meaning of the word unworthy from saying he was unworthy of winning the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
And to illustrate these subtleties, having written a definition saying unworthy to accept, receive the Nobel Prize is a certain sense of unworthy, you've got to produce an illustrative quotation. Let me give you a more amusing example of an invented series of quotations mm-hmm. for the word radium. I love the story of radium because it also shows the human foibles that plagued the making of the dictionary. Radium was discovered by the Curies in 1897, and the first appearance of the word radium is in Science magazine in this country and in Nature in London, saying we have discovered a new element, and because it emits rays, we're going to call it radium. This is the first time it appears in print, and therefore is fodder for the dictionary. So the word comes to Murray's attention, and being very, very cautious, he says, I'm not sure that radium's going to last. I don't think that... They're working on the letter, and indeed they're working on RA at this very time, mm-hmm. 1897, 1898. But he says, ah, no, he says, don't think so. I think he had this idea of half-life or something like that, and thought that the word would never come into common parlance. So he said no. He made this rather autocratic and, as it happens, wrong decision, which he righted in 1933 when they produced a supplement. But this enraged other members of his, enraged in a very polite Victorian way, of his editorial team, particularly a man called Bayliss and another called Sweetman. And between the two of them, and it's wonderful to have found the handwritten entries they had created, they came up with a spoof definition of radium. And first of all, they produced this amazing etymology, quoting origins from languages such as prehistoric and antediluvian. It means the unknown quantity. And then they have fun with a great number of quotations, such as one from Aristotle. Such and such, he says, radium may be obtained from the excrement of a squint-eyed rat that has died of a broken heart buried 50 feet below the highest depths of the Western Ocean in a well-stocked tobacco tin. But Sir Thomas Browne says this is a vulgar error. He also refutes the story that it was dug in the air above Mount Olympus by the ancients. And then they go on collecting quotes from 1669 Pepys's diary, 31st of June, you know, rather mm-hmm. laboured joke here.
Yeah.
And so to bed, found radium, an excellent pick-me-up in the morning. 1873, Hymns Ancient and Modern, number 2517, Thy walls, O Lord, are built of radium. And 1600, Hakluyt's Voyages, volume 4, chapter 21, The king was attired simply in a hat of silk and carrying a radium umbrella. I mean, what erudition yeah. these men
Great.
Displayed. They were wonderful
yeah.
characters.
They do the full, they finish Z, they publish the whole thing, and it appears in 1928. But even so, the language is, of course, changing underfoot. In fact, if they went serially from A through Z, they must be particularly deficient under A, because...
They were. Actually, there are two things to say about that. And first of all, just to correct you, if I may, they didn't finish with Z. Because Z or Z, as we, I think,
as you, I'm as coming, you properly say,
I'm becoming infected with living here so long. Z, the last word in the dictionary is zixt, Z-Y-X-T, which is a Sussex vernacular version of the verb to see, or he zixed him.
Mm-hmm.
That was quite easy, and so Z was finished in about 1919. So the volume that they actually worked on last of all was W, and the last word that was completed was a word in the volume Wise to Wizen, W-Y-Z-E-N. And Wizen is a Scottish word for the esophagus, for the gullet.
Mm-hmm.
But the other point you make, I think is absolutely fascinating, is something I discovered when I was doing this book, that the current editors of the new version of the Oxford English Dictionary don't start with the letter A, because they looked back at the etymology and the lexicographical quality of those early letters, A, B, and C. And B, oddly enough, is a very, very difficult letter, one of the most difficult in the language.
You mean because there are so many B words?
Well, and because they have very curious etymologies. I mean, it's to go into it in detail will tax me, but it is writ that B was a much more difficult letter than anyone imagined. A, B, and C, Murray and his team were feeling their way, if you like. And A, B, and C in the OED, the sort of lexicographical equivalent of a Friday car. You never want to buy a car that's made just before everyone's nipping off to, you know, to the pub to have a weekend, because it's all shoddily assembled, or so you suspect. Similarly, with those first words in the OED, you think there's a certain hesitancy about them. They really don't get into their stride until, you know, J and K and L, which is why the editors of the new version, the third edition of the OED, are not beginning with A at all. They're beginning with M, because they feel that what they're building on is words that are really solidly done by Murray and his crew, and that their own hesitancy and the new approach they're taking will be cancelled out by the solidity of Murray's work.
It was probably a good 20 years ago that Robert Birchfield came on this program. He was then the editor of the OED, and they had just published, was it a four-volume supplement?
Yes, they began...
That was in 1980-something.
Yes, the first one was in 75, and the last one, I think, was in either 82 or 84.
Yeah.
So then you had, and I remember because I owned them all, I bought them during a typhoon in Hong Kong when I was living there, loading 17 volumes, as the OED was in those days, into a taxi during this furious rainstorm. But what you had is worth explaining. You had volumes 1 to 12, the original OED. Then you had the supplement produced in 1933 that included words like radium, that Murray didn't want to include, included the word bondmaid, which was the only word that was actually missing. It was lost in the construction of the first one. The word African. Murray had this visceral opposition to producing adjectives from national names. He said, no, if we have African, then we've got to have Armenian and Albanian and Azerbaijanian, and where does it end? But then he came to American and American eyes.
Can't leave that out.
And you said you can't leave that out, so we ought to have African. But he had already passed AF, so he put it in the 1933 supplement. So you've got volumes 1 to 12, then you've got the 13th volume, also in alphabetical order, the 1933 supplement, and then the four that Robert Birchfield, who was your guest, I would surmise, about 20 years ago, produced in the 1970s and early 1980s. So if you wanted to look up any word, you had to go to first the 12 volumes, then the 13th, then the four supplements. Very confusing.
Of course, some years ago they brought out the same thing, but in two great super volumes in miniature print together with a magnifying glass.
They did, and it became a bestseller in this country because it was used by the Book of the Month Club something to tempt you into joining and buying four books, you know, every year. They would give you, I think, either free or for a derisory price, $15, I think. And so a lot of people bought it, whether they used the magnifying glass for looking at the dictionary or, you know, looking at insects or their toenails, I don't know. But you see an awful lot of, or hear an awful lot of people saying, oh, yes, I've got the OED in the two volumes.
What form is it in now? That is, I know it's also available on the internet, and you have to pay for that. And that also is open to continued further editing,
yes,
and constant inclusion of new words.
What happened was that in 1989, with the assistance of a lot of money from IBM and some technical expertise from the University of Waterloo in Canada, they amalgamated all of those original 17 volumes, the 12, the 13th, and the four supplements, into one, putting everything in its proper alphabetical place, and adding some new words to that. So that, which is the second edition of the OED, which is the one that's on sale today, if you were to go into your friendly bookstore and are willing to pay quite a lot of money, you'd get 20 volumes. That is now...
So they are still issuing it in bound volumes.
They most certainly are.
A full set of 20.
Yes, and every time they print it, they've just printed in England about... they printed in England, they printed in Tokyo, and I think they printed in somewhere in the United States. They've just ordered up another printing, and they produce about 5,000 copies a time. So that's 5,000 times 20, which is 100,000 books.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what exists at the moment, but and that is also available as a CD-ROM and online. But in addition to that, they're now working furiously on producing the third edition, and that is going to be a monster. And the decision that they're having to come, they're going to have to make it very soon, is whether they produce that in a hard copy or not. Because they say now, I was led to believe it will come out in 2010, but it won't. The new publication date for the third edition of the OED is 2037, when John Simpson, who is the editor, will almost certainly not be alive, sad to say. So he will suffer the same fate as James Murray and Henry Bradley and Frederick Furnival and Coleridge suffered.
Up to date with the current operative edition, how many words are there?
The current operative edition, 680,000. The third edition to be, extrapolating from the 414,000 that were in the first edition, 680,000 today, it'll probably be about 950 to a million words. And the next edition will weigh probably a sixth of a ton if it comes out as a book.
It is commonly claimed that English has by far the largest vocabulary of any language in the world. Can that be proven, or is it just an imperial assertion?
A man called John Wilinski at Princeton, with whom I'm supposed to have a debate in Vancouver in about a month's time, says it's an imperial assertion. And he derides the dictionary, of course, for being the product of old, white, bearded, dead men with Victorian sensibilities.
Indeed, some of these attitudes. Guys really were bearded, weren't they?
Most certainly, they had spectacular beards.
We've got a picture of Murray on the cover of your book, and he looks like an ancient rabbi to me.
He does. It's a wonderful, it's called a swallowtail beard.
Yeah.
And to see him riding down, he used to ride a tricycle everywhere. He abhorred motor cars. And he would ride this Humber tricycle down the streets of Oxford. And there's a lovely quote from Sir William Osler, who was the Regius Professor at Medicine, saying, as he saw Murray cycling down the street, with Murray now probably 78 years old and looking somewhat frail, Osler said, "You know, here at Oxford, they are only keeping me alive, or keeping me in my job, I think, so that I can make sure that that old curmudgeon remains alive so he can complete his dictionary." But he didn't. He died in 1915. It is commonly believed that the last word that Murray edited was the word turndown, which is rather a nice piece of symmetry because, of course, he was turned down for that British Museum job for failing to... No Phoenician, probably. But in fact, it was the word 20th. We've now found the last word that Murray was responsible for was 20th, which seems even more appropriate because he edited a very 20th century book.
But you say that you'll be debating the question of whether English really is the fullest language in the world in terms of vocabulary, or whether that's a claim of imperial quality itself.
Yes, I think there's very little doubt that it is the largest language, although the OED is not the largest dictionary. The Grimmsche Wörterbuch in Germany, the Grimm brothers, the fairy tale tellers, were principally known in Germany as lexicographers. And their book is, I think at the moment, 32 volumes in length. And there are some great national dictionaries. The Swedish National Dictionary, for instance, has been continuously edited since, I believe, 1902, and is still stuck on the letter S. So they've got a long way to go. But then again, of course, here in Chicago, you've got some amazing dictionaries being produced. The Hittite, the Chaldean, the Sumerian dictionaries.
All of the University of Chicago.
All of the University of Chicago. Yeah. So dictionary making, if you take it seriously, and people like Murray certainly did, is a monumental and, so far as the English language is concerned, never-ending task.
Speaking of things being never-ending, and with the biblical... allusion in mind of the making of dictionaries, there is no end. We just had the publisher, a very active publisher he is, of the Merriam-Webster Collegiate on this program, together with a good friend of yours.
Aaron McKean.
Aaron McKean, who is based in Chicago, but has a large hand in the American edition of the Oxford Dictionary of the English Language.
Yes, so it's called the... they've at last dropped the word American English at Oxford. They call it the American Dictionary.
Yeah.
And the acceptance that American has in a very large measure diverged and should be called American rather than just a subset of the English.
But the making of dictionaries is a big publishing business, is it not?
It is huge, particularly in this country. I mean, there's fierce competition. And if you remember, a few years ago, Microsoft entered the lists by producing a dictionary called the Encarta Dictionary, which trumpeted the fact that 341 skilled lexicographers working night and day for 5 years have produced this wonderful dictionary.
The great early American dictionary, or the first major American dictionary, is Noah Webster's.
Noah Webster, yes.
Which dates, what, to the 1840s or thereabouts?
Yes, thereabouts. And it was huge. I mean, the Webster's Third International Dictionary, one of the great dictionaries in terms of the number of words included, more than the OED.
And do you use the famous anecdote about Noah Webster being surprised, caught by his wife with a serving girl on his knee?
I do not know this story.
No, there's a great story. She pops in and to his study, and there he is with a servant girl on his knee. And she says, "Mr. Webster, I am surprised." And his response is, "No, my dear, you are astonished. I am surprised."
Very good. Peasant to the end.
You do say that he was quite a pedantic fellow.
Yes.
It's time for us to go to some commercials and to invite telephone calls. We're opening the lines at this instant. And the number, of course, is 591-7200, 591-7200. If you're listening to us in Australia today and today, and you want to pose a question or offer a thought, you can do that by email quite easily. But we had one telephone call from Australia not long ago. But the email address, wherever you are in the world, is extension 720 as one word, extension 720, at Tribune, TRIBUNE.com. Extension 720 at Tribune.com, or more commonly 591-7200 for phone calls. The lines are open. If you get your calls in quickly, whether there's a word you want to ask about, a thought about language, a thought about dictionaries, or simply a question about the making of the OED, do by all means call us instantly on 591-7200, and we return after this. And we will go directly to the phones, 591-7200, except there is a bit of a problem. I discover that my headset is not plugged in, so you want to whistle a little tune while
well,
I do that?
Well, I can listen on my headset. But I'll whistle Dixie, if you like.
I finally found it, and
well,
we are ready to go. If you want to whistle Dixie, though, please go
ahead.
No,
no, please.
591-7200, and here is the first call. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, simple question, I think. How does one go about purchasing an OED, and is it available on CD-ROM? And finally, what would the asking price be?
Well, at the moment I understand, and I don't want to sound like I'm a snake oil salesman or anything like that, but I know that there's a special offer of the OED at the moment, because it's 75 years old, the first edition coming out in 1928. So it's normally $3,000, but it is now $895. And you simply either go to your bookstore and order it, and they'll be happy to do so. Few of them stock it because it's so very big. The alternatives to that are that you can buy it on CD-ROM quite expensively. I think it's about $450, although maybe if Erin McKean is listening, she will ring in and tell us the exact price. And the third possibility is to get it online. If you go to www.oed.com, they'll instruct you how to do it. That is about $30 a month, so it's an affordable price for people that are very keen on the language. And that gives you the advantage of having the third edition. So they're at the moment, they've done all the words from M to, I think they're on to N now, just about as far as published words, although the actual word they're working on at the moment in Oxford is a words beginning with O-V. So that you can get all of everything from the first and second editions and M to N.
O-V. Our thanks to the caller. Will they include Ovaltine?
I believe they will, because the Ovaltine and the Ovaltinis, the children that used to sing the Ovaltine commercial, are well annealed into the English language. I think they will.
Good. 591-7200, and here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, my question is, what edition do you think would be the best dictionary for a child between the ages of, let's say, 11 and 14 that's just starting to work with a dictionary?
Well, that's a very good question. I think 12 to 13, and I always think that, you know, your reach should exceed your grasp, or whatever the phrase is, that you should give a dictionary that the child is likely to grow into rather than one that is dumbing down. I would say the concise Oxford, not the shorter Oxford, which is a pretty big and heavy book, but the concise Oxford is in one volume. There's also what's called the NODI, the New Oxford Dictionary of English, or NOAD, the New Oxford American Dictionary. Both of those are single volume dictionaries, and they are beautifully produced stylistically and very easy to use. So my waffling here is I'm slightly thinking out loud, and I think of all those choices, probably for your 11 to 13 year old, I would say NOAD, the New Oxford American Dictionary.
Great, thank you.
We thank you, ma'am. Glad to have heard from you. 591-7200. There's one line available at this very moment, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen. I was wondering what the official position of the OED, as well as your guest's personal attitude, toward made-up words that we don't need but apparently are intended for the mollification of, for lack of a better term, the hoi polloi. Well, things like what drives me nuts is deplane. When the actual word is disembark, it's a perfectly good word.
Or get off.
Depending on what you're doing, of course.
My attitude, and I'm sure John Simpson's attitude back in Oxford and the attitude of Jesse Scheidlauer, who's the American editor of the OED based in New York, is that although we may regret the inelegance and unseemliness of these words, if it is written down, if it's in the English language, then we have to accept that it's there and it has to go in the dictionary. Fowler's modern English usage, is the kind of book that might well inveigh against the use of a word like deplane and say, as you have rightly said in my view, that disembark is a far prettier word. But if it's in the language, ugly or not, it's in the dictionary.
Well, then at what point does it cross over into what you just termed in the language? What's the line of demarcation there?
In the language generally means having appeared legitimately in print between 10 and 15 times. If people can find in newspapers and magazines and books perhaps the word deplane, and it is sent in to the editors in Oxford at the Clarendon Press, Walton Street, Oxford, then its simple appearance between 10 and 15 times, legitimately, not, you know, they can weed out stunts, will suggest to them that that is in the language and therefore it's got to be in the book.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
We thank you, sir.
Yeah.
There are now a number of lines available, and you are more than welcome to join to raise a question about the English language, raise a question about the Oxford English Dictionary, or offer us a word that you think needs to be included but is not yet included. For any and all such purposes, 591-7200 is the number. Somebody once did a contest, may even have been the people at Oxford University Press, though probably not. But they asked a lot of prominent people, what is the most pleasing word in the English language, just for the sound, for the euphony of it? And they got all sorts of answers. What would yours be?
I mean, many people talk about summer dawn or cellar door.
Cellar door
being a
famous
one
of them, yes.
For me, this is going to sound awfully precocious, but my mother insists that the first word I uttered after the obligatory mama and papa was the word capybara, which sounds very peculiar, but near where we live, north of London, there was a zoo called Whipsnade. And I apparently was enraptured, as I still am today, it's my favorite animal, by this wonderful South American rodent called a capybara, which looks like an enormous walking shredded wheat. They're the friendliest, loveliest animals. They're extremely lazy. They live in the water and they just eat fruit and they harm nobody. And they're very pretty. And I pointed at this thing and I said to my mother's astonishment, capybara. And it remains today the word that I'm feel most affectionately disposed towards.
Really?
Yes.
Mine was cellophane, which comes very close to cellar door.
Yes.
There's something about the sibilance, and it just flows beautifully. Do you know any really ugly words? Just in terms of sound.
Well, I was going to say a pretty word, which means an ugly thing, which isn't what you're asking at all, is the word retromingent, which I think is a rather interesting word.
Retromingent?
Retromingent.
What is that?
It means urinating backwards.
Good heavens.
Yes, apparently tapirs are retromingent. Really? Someone who's standing behind a tapir in a zoo once found to his cost. So beware the retromingent animal. Stand in front, not behind him.
One of the great delights of reading in dictionaries is, of course, etymology. And sometimes you get surprises, sometimes it's fairly obvious, but you discover that you've been using words which are essentially French or Latin all your life, and you didn't know that they were. I just went at random into the second volume of the shorter Oxford English Dictionary, which I've got before me, and literally I turned to a page in which we have the word revenge. No, I've never thought about that at all. Have you? Can you derive that word? Can you reason that etymologically backward?
I would assume it would be, I was going to say, well, Latin, vanquere.
Well, what we've got here is from the verb, French, revenge, or revenge, and revanche, perenne, modern, revanche. So they don't really say anything about the Latin origin, but if it's in French,
it should be Latin.
It has a Latin origin.
I think travel is one of the most interesting things. I mean, that comes from, we think of travel as being a very pleasurable thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it originally comes from the word tripalium, which is a Latin instrument of torture. It was rather like an easel that you were attached to and had your limbs stretched. And tripalium evolved in the French into travail, meaning mm-hmm. work, something yeah. that was hard and difficult and onerous. And then going on a travail, going on a hard and difficult expedition, transmuted itself eventually into travel. And so something that, you know, we think of as essentially a great luxury has its origin in something which was a great difficulty.
One of the great origins, I learned this a long time ago when I was a high school kid, I think, is the word assassin. You know that one, don't you?
From hashish.
From hashish.
Yes.
And do you know the detail on that one?
I believe the hashish were men that were given drugs in order to persuade them to kill people.
They were, and they worked for a particular charismatic figure who had religious claims within the Islamic culture. In fact, in modern Iran, I think, who was known as the Old Man of the Mountain. And his killers were known as the Hashashan.
That's right.
Thus, assassin.
The word thug, thug.
That's Indian in
origin,
isn't it?
That's Hindi from thuggy,
yeah.
Which is a practice to placate the goddess Kali by strangling and choke and robbing people. So it was a form of, or dacoity, as it's also called.
Yeah.
Thuggy was a religious act when you kill someone to placate this god. I also like the word posh, because it's not what you think. I mean, posh.
Port out, starboard, backward is.
Port out, starboard, home
is a fake etymology, I guess.
It's a fake etymology because the word posh long predates the shipping lines that went to Bombay.
Do we know the derivation?
No, we don't. Then its origin obscure, it says in the OED, but simply origin much older than shipping labels that were put on Bombay bound passengers' baggage.
I had somebody on this program a number of years ago who had done a book about the mafia, and he says with absolute authority in the opening chapter, that is an acronym for a Sicilian saying condemning the French when the French ruled Sicily. It's, how did it go? Malatesta alla francese, no, maledizione alla francese, Sicilia arrivata, which is curses on the French, Sicily will rise.
And
I mentioned it rather recently, I forget in what context, but again on the air, to somebody who really knew these matters, who said, well, yes, but historically, the word goes back far, is far more recent than the French occupation of Sicily, which is
yes.
dated sort of in the Middle Ages or something.
Well, I have my fishmonger in the store that I use in in Massachusetts, where I live, who insists till he's blue in the face that the word cod stands for catch of the day.
Oh, yes.
And I
don't. It should.
It should. Yeah. But I insist that he's wrong.
Back to the phones. 591-7200. Good evening. You're on the air.
Good evening. Before my question, I have a little story about the OED from the Book of the Month Club, and I'm partially cited it. In the past, I have used a machine with a closed-circuit television camera capable of 40 power magnification, and I must say that the OED from Book of the Month Club is the only book that has ever required the full 40 power just to make it readable.
Mm-hmm. Believe that.
And I... there were so many friends that I wanted to call tonight and tell them about this program, but I realized that I would miss it myself if I did so. And so there was one who got singled out. If she's still listening, she may know that. And I'm grateful for your contagious enthusiasm because of one of my fears. I fear that this kind of dictionary in an age of sound bites rather than love of language is going to go largely ignored by the majority of people, and I frankly hope that I'm wrong. I'm wondering if you could give us a statistic or a conjecture as to whether this dictionary will always remain a minority or elite interest, or are there more converts out there than we know about?
Well, I can't give you any statistical or even anecdotal evidence, really, but I can tell you that the sales of the OED have gone through the roof in recent years.
Oh, that's wonderful.
I mean, let me tell you what happened. In 1998, when this book that I wrote called The Surgeon of Crowthorne, or The Professor and the Madman, it was called in this country, came out, the head of Oxford University Press in New York rang Oxford in Oxford to say, how many copies of the OED do you have in the warehouse? And they said, we've got about 3,000 copies left. And she said, how many do you sell a year? And they said, about 50. We sell about one a week. And she said, well, I think we can use The Professor and the Madman to rekindle interest in the OED. I'll take all of them. So put them all on a ship and send them over to me in New York, and I will sell them. And so she did. She's called Laura Brown. She's still president of Oxford America. She sold all those 2,000 or 3,000 OEDs at a stunningly reduced price. I mean, I think the list price is $3,000. They reduced them to about $950. This was 5 years ago. And the printers, such was the enthusiasm for the book among people who bought it, that they, like you ringing your friend and suggesting she listens, that they bought it too. They decided that $900 was well worth paying to get this incredible piece of scholarship and something that looks very beautiful. I mean, these 20 blue and gold volumes just look stunning. And they've been back to the printers something like 11 times with 5,000 copies a time. So a huge number of the OED have been sold. Plus, you've got NOAD, you've got Noddy. Suddenly, there seems to be a resurgence in new dictionaries as opposed to the same old Webster.
Could I just comment that I wish that more people knew that exploring the pleasures of a word and its highways and byways is almost as transcendental sometimes as a religious ecstasy.
Well, I'm delighted. I mean, I share your enthusiasm. The other day I was on a radio call-in show somewhat like this from New York, and a fellow rang in and said, because unfortunately people, I don't know, I don't have a particularly large vocabulary, but he said, he put me on the spot and said, okay, what does this word mean? And he came up with the word delope, D-E-L-O-P-E. Well, like most people, I'd never heard of the word delope.
Did you break up an elopement?
No, well, quite. I stumbled and thought it might be something like that. But I did have the OED on CD-ROM in front of me on my computer. And so taking care not to make a sound that would be picked up by the microphone, I typed it out. He was telephoning from Nebraska. And during a moment of dead air, I typed D-E-L-O-P-E. And then I said to him, yes, sir, delope, delope. Isn't that the word that's when someone is involved in a duel, they fire their gun harmlessly into the air? And from Nebraska came this little voice which said, I hate you.
Well, That's wonderful.
But people consequent upon that story remember the word delope. It was reintroduced into the language by Georgette Heyer, who wrote those wonderful bodice-ripping novels about 40 years ago. And it's thanks to people like her that the language is, we are reminded of words that slip into disfavor. And I mean, I had a news editor on The Guardian when I was a reporter there 20 or 30 years ago. He used to put up a word on the bulletin board in the newsroom every Monday, a somewhat obscure word, and said the first reporter that can get this legitimately into his copy during this week will win a pint of beer. And I remember the word poetaster, P-O-E-T-A-S-T-E-R, a composer of doggerel, got into the, that was on the list. And I happened to be in Belfast at the time, and I was doing an article on the graffiti, the insulting graffiti, put on the gable ends of houses by Catholics and Protestants who were trying to best each other in producing vile sort of short aphorisms. And one of them wrote in poetry, and I said, the sloganeering on the gable ends of walls in the Shankill Road in Belfast is so bad, not even the meanest poetaster in all the British Isles would wish to be credited with it. And Harry Hewell, the news editor, when he received the copy, said, I've got two things to say to you. That's going in the newspaper tomorrow, and you've won your pint of beer. So people that encourage us to use words, words that are in danger of being forgotten, I applaud thoroughly.
Well, if anyone ever says to me, we must elope, and I feel compelled to say no, I will fire a gun harmlessly in the air by way of saying no, and I will elope.
Good for you.
Thank you, sir, for the call. Very glad to have heard from you. We pause for the usual reasons, the last round of commercials, then directly back to the phones, 591-7200. And if you've been trying to reach us and not getting through, you can always try the email. The email address, extension 720 at tribune.com. And speaking of our audio archive, we just put up a number of additional programs that were played fairly recently. John McWhorter, the author of Doing Our Own Thing, The Degradation of Language and Music and Why We Should Like Care, is the title of that book. We talked a lot about language lately. Also, another visitor from the UK was with us recently, namely John Cornwell, and we did a full discussion of his new book, Hitler's Scientists, fascinating material that Cornwell has pulled together. And still earlier, we discussed with Maeve Leakey, one of the famous Leakeys of Kenya, paleoanthropological family, the leading one in the world, undoubtedly, and with two other paleoanthropologists, we discussed simply where Homo sapiens comes from. The book by one of our guests, namely Jonathan Kingdon, was titled Lowly Origin, Where, When, and Why Our Ancestors First Stood Up. Those programs and a great deal else. Oh, and our recent conversation with Judge Robert Bork as well is now up on the archive. All of those are available if you just go to WGN Radio and then click on my name and then click on Audio Archive, and there it is, and you click once again, you can hear the program. 591-7200 is the number as we go to this caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm curious about the word suffrage. It's a positive thing to me, but the word doesn't come across as a positive sound.
Yes. Of course, it means the right to vote. And, you know, I knew that that was your question. And so I've gone to the shorter Oxford English Dictionary, and I don't find suffrage in it.
Are you serious? S-U-F-F-R-A-G-E?
Yes, I hand you, sir, the volume if it doesn't knock you over.
I'm astonished. Talk about among yourselves while I look for it myself.
Well, of course, you've got suffer and many other derivatives. It may be in there, but not as a separate word with a full heading.
Oh, here it is.
You did find it.
I did.
What did I do wrong?
I think you didn't know how to spell it.
Quite possibly so.
Sorry. Well, it's S-U-F-F-R-A-G-E.
Yeah.
Not, you were looking at S-U-F-E-R-A-G-E.
Good heavens, I must have been doing so, yes.
Suffrage, I do beg your pardon. It's just going to sound most disrespectful. I didn't mean to say that.
Not at all.
But it is here. And the etymology appears to be Latin suffragum and French suffrage, which means to do with voting. But it's talking about intercessory prayers, prayers for the souls of the departed, liturgical intercessory petitions, A vote given by a member of a body, state, or society in assent to a proposal or in favor of the election of a person, generally a vote in support of or opinion in favor of some person or thing. So it's essentially of religious origin.
Right. I understand the meaning of it. I just think it's a little curious that it relates to or sounds like an overtly negative, like suffer.
It does, but suffer itself comes from a very different etymology, and I think, yes, from souffrir. And I think, therefore, one has to be, to use John McWhorter's phrase, care has to be employed in the way you pronounce it. You suffer, but you have suffrage.
Right.
And once you've dealt with that. But then again, you have suffer little children to come unto me. This is another meaning of the word suffer, which is a very genial meaning.
It means allow, doesn't it?
It means permit, yes,
permit,
exactly.
Yeah.
If you could permit me to ask another question, I would enjoy that. I pulled up, my second question isn't what I told the announcer before, but I pulled over on the side of the road, and as I was watching trucks go by, this came to mind, flammable versus inflammable. I always taught it's inflammable means to burn or to be able to burn, and now it seems as if people use flammable as the word to burn.
There are so many of these forms. They have a name which begins with A, which is words which seem to be their opposite, and unloosen.
Antonyms, eh?
It's not an antonym. It's a word which is it does begin with A N T. But it's, once again, I wish Erin McKeon would ring up from her home in North Chicago. But yes, which is the better to set?
I always was taught was it was inflammable.
Me too. I would favor inflammable, but. The precise difference between the two is minimal.
But this happens not only with individual words, but with whole phrases. For example, it always drives me up the wall when somebody says, I could care less.
Yes, I rather like...
They really mean, I couldn't care less.
And I remember once this discussion about whether the double negative was a formation found in... It's not found in Russian, oddly enough. But then they were talking about that there is no double positive.
And the answer was that Sidney Morgan Besser, the philosopher linguist at Columbia University, sitting at the back of the hall, as somebody made that assertion, there is no such thing as a double positive in the English language.
And so
Morgan Besser shouted, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, or yeah, right.
No, that's double negative is yeah, yeah. Well, yeah, it could be
Double positive is yeah, right.
Double positive.
Yes.
I should have said, I'm confusing myself. The assertion was there's no double positive, and his answer, the famous one, done in a slightly Yiddish lilt, is yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And we thank that caller, and we go quickly to another. Hello, you're on the air.
Yes, I was listening to how you discern when a word becomes legitimate by print, and I was wondering, are slang words legitimate, and when do they become legitimate, and also, when does a foreign word become adopted into the English language?
Good question, sir, but your phone is rather poor, so we'll proceed with it, having said goodnight to you, I fear.
The same rules apply, really. If the foreign word, and I'm at the moment dealing with a new thesaurus that's being produced also by Oxford, on the word Uber and the word Ur. So to talk about an Uber city or the OED being
now, there,
we
had a discussion about that in our conversation before we went on the air, and you're telling me that Uber is the German word, of course, is now used in American English parlance, and I have never heard it.
Well, and this is the point your caller on the not-too-good connection just now was wondering about, how often does it have to appear? Well, we've come up with dozens upon dozens of quotations of the use of the word Uber in all sorts of, in Rolling Stone, in promotional material, in advertising. Mm-hmm. So the word Uber is very much out there. The word UR has been out there for a long time.
Yeah, that
time,
I've heard, yeah. He's written the ultimate or book on
exactly,
something or other. Yeah.
So this really answers that question quite neatly, because that word has now appeared in print so many times that it is part of the English language.
A last call coming up, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Yes, good evening, Milt and Mr. Winchester. I originally called with a real boring comment. I was calling with what I thought was the dumbest sounding word in English, which I told your producer was bubble.
Mm-hmm.
But while I was listening
to... No, but that's an that's an onomatopoetic word. It sounds like that which it describes.
Well, while I was listening to all your other callers, I thought of the great Tonight Show guest, Tony Randall, who once did a little routine, a little shtick, where he talked about, he used three Romance languages, and then he ended up with two of the Indo-Europeans. And the five words he used, just to show the beauty, I'm thinking of your word cellophane, he came up with mariposa, farfalla, papillon, and then he switched to the Indo-European, where we have butterfly and schmetterling. And I think that kind of sums it all up.
I think you're, it's a lovely joke that, but I think butterfly is attractive. But I think you're absolutely right. Schmetterling is vile.
Schmetterling.
And to describe such an elegant creature as a butterfly or a falfalia or a papillon.
I kind of like the mariposa or the papillon.
Beautiful words.
Exactly.
But schmetterling just...
And then one quick other question for Milt. You've got a two-volume set. I'm a frugal kind of person.
It's the shorter Oxford, and I don't know what it costs, but possibly Simon does.
I think it probably will say on the inside flap, it's not expensive. I think it's down in the $75 range, so it's considerably less than the $895,
which is
the
special. I mean, that's more my style.
Well, but it is the shorter. You get what you pay for.
Ma'am, we thank you. We're just about out of time.
Okay,
right
thank
now.
You. Bye-bye.
Good night. Thanks for waiting as long as you have. Well, of course, you've had an incredible career. You've got about 15 books to your credit. And you're working on one now about the San Francisco earthquake, is that right?
Yes, it's nice of you to say 15 books, most of them vanishingly obscure that nobody ever bothered to
but
read.
But I discovered only tonight that one of them, which is titled Prison Diary, Argentina, I think, is based upon real-life experience.
Yes, I was put in prison for spying for 3 months in Argentina during the Falklands War, and I turned that into a book.
When you were there as a British journalist?
Yes, I was... pursuing my trade, but the Argentines thought otherwise and locked me up.
You were actually under sentence of death.
Yes, which, as Oscar Wilde or someone said, concentrates the mind wonderfully. But then once we won the war...
It was Dr. Johnson who said it.
But there we go.
He says it to Boswell. You may count upon it, sir, nothing so concentrates a man's mind as the certain knowledge that he will be hanged in a fortnight.
Well, I was uncertain as to when, but it was going to come fairly rapidly. Anyway, it didn't. And
that redeems me from the my mistake on suffrage. At any rate, we are out of time. Simon Winchester's book that we've been drawing from tonight is The Meaning of Everything, The Story of the Oxford English Dictionary, and it's published, not coincidentally, by Oxford University Press. Monday night, we talked with three reporters who were embedded during the Iraq War, that is, who went along with American troops, in one case, with American naval forces. Tuesday, our guest will be Winston S. Churchill, the grandson of Winston Churchill, who's done a new book about Churchill's greatest speeches. And we will, of course, play excerpts from some of those speeches. Wednesday, a program that asks, is war just? Peter Temis, who used to be the editor of the Encyclopedia Britannica, has done that book. He will be our guest together with others. Thursday, we look at contemporary politics with Senator Paul Simon and with Joe Morris, a liberal and a conservative. And Friday, we examine the state of the American economy with two former members of the Council of Economic Advisors. For now, thanks to all for listening, and a cordial good night.